Hey everybody, it's Eugene here, and welcome to Forensics Talks. This is going to be episode 98, and my guest today is Mark Davison. And Mark Davison is a 17-year veteran with the Connecticut State Police, and he's currently holding the rank of Lieutenant Colonel. He served the majority of his career in major crime, primarily as a crime scene detective and supervisor. Following promotion to lieutenant, he commanded the Troop L Barracks, the Training Academy, and the state's Western District, and he's currently the commander of the Office of Administrative Services. Mark holds a certification from the IAI in bloodstain pattern analysis and actively assists with BPA and shooting reconstruction casework. He's taught several training courses on BPA, shooting reconstruction, and crime scene investigation. He holds a bachelor degree in systems engineering from the U.S. Naval Academy and a master's in forensic science from the University of New Haven. He's been an adjunct instructor at the University of New Haven for the past 8 years, teaching a variety of courses in the forensic science department. And he's also taught as an adjunct at Central Connecticut State University and served for 8 years as an officer in the United States Marine Corps. Now, I think I first met Mark at an IABPA conference. That's the International Association of Bloodstain Pattern Analysts in Portland, Maine. That's kind of where I first remember him from some time back. But last year, Mark did a presentation at the Association for Crime Scene Reconstruction. And in fact, there's another meeting for that next week. So next week, I'll be in Texas at the Association for Crime Scene Reconstruction, or ACER. But that's where I first saw Mark's presentation on the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting. And it really struck me as a very honest and open presentation. And there were a lot of really interesting things that came out of that, at least for me. And what really sort of got my interest was later on, I was at another conference in October, actually just last October, 2023. And this was just shortly after the shooting that happened in Maine. And many of you might remember that one. But there were a number of officers there, and we were having a very interesting conversation about sort of what happened. These are people that were actively on duty at the time, and a lot of the same issues that came up during my conversation with them was exactly what Mark had highlighted in his presentation. And so I think after that time, I said, you know what, I really got to get Mark on here to talk. So just before I get Mark in here, I'll just do a very, very brief summary of the Sandy Hook, the school shooting. And so this occurred on December 14th, 2012, and this was in Newtown, Connecticut. It was one of the deadliest shootings in United States history. And on that morning, there was a 20-year-old man who fatally shot 20 children aged between 6 and 7 years old, as well as adult staff members. And I think there were 6 adult staff members that were shot. Before going to the school, the shooter shot and killed his mother at their home. And upon arriving at Sandy Hook Elementary, he entered the building by shooting through a locked glass door and at the front entrance. He was armed with a semi-automatic rifle and 2 handguns. And as he moved through the first grade classrooms, that's sort of where he committed the mass shooting. And eventually he took his own life with one of the handguns, as you know, law enforcement officers were arriving at the scene. And the whole incident lasted roughly 11 minutes from the time the shooter entered the school until he ended his life. And many of you will remember this as a very, very shocking and just a very big story that made the news. It just affected a lot of people and was a really, really eye-opening event for many. Now, I'm going to bring Mark in here, so just give me a second. I'm going to get him back. And there he is. Hey, Mark, how you doing?
Hey, Eugene, how's it going? Good to see you.
Thank you so much. Yeah, thanks for your patience back there. Yeah, I was thinking, was the IABPA where we first met in Portland?
Yeah, 2014. That was it.
Okay, I was trying to remember what year it was, but I knew so we're getting on to 10 years, my friend.
Yeah, that's right. Some
time ago. Well, we're going to get into the whole Sandy Hook thing, but let me just ask you a little bit regarding yourself. I saw that, you were in the Marine Corps and stuff like that. So when I like going back in time, even before then, like when little Mark was being the previous little kid running around, like, was your family already in law enforcement and Army and stuff like that? Like, did you know that this was going to be your career path?
No, that was, I guess it kind of materialized as I grew up. I mean, my dad was in the Navy, and I don't know that really had too much of an effect on me as a younger person, but I mean, really, as I started applying to colleges, to me, one looked like the next until I got to the Naval Academy. I was a wrestler in high school. I was recruited for wrestling a bit. I went down there for a visit, and that that environment struck me as like this is the place that's suited for me. So I kind of went from there. I never wanted to drive a ship for a living, so hence the Marine Corps. And, you know, things kind of went from there. So
right on. Then tell me about the systems engineering thing. That was a new one for me. So what was your plan there?
I mean, you know, ultimately my plan at the Naval Academy was to become commissioned as a Marine officer. You know, obviously education is very important. I'd always been interested in math and science. My dad was a mechanical engineer, so there was likely some influence there. And so, you know, as you matriculate as a freshman or a plebe at the Naval Academy, kind of fishing around for where you want to end up. I mean, there's a lot of technical majors there. The 2/3 of them are technical. So that was kind of the track I embarked on.
Okay. And at the State Police, right, at Connecticut State Police right now, have you had many different roles? Like, what was your journey through there? Like, where you started and then sort of the journey you took up to now?
Yeah, ultimately there. So, I mean, every trooper here starts on patrol. I worked out of the barracks at Troop G, which is in Bridgeport, which is pretty much patrol in southwestern Connecticut on 95. So I was there for 3 years. I kind of my goal relative to the State Police was to become a detective in major crimes. So ultimately, after around 3 years, took a test, street detective for a short time, and then went over to the crime scene unit. And kind of fell in love with the forensic aspect of that type of work. So that part wasn't really on my radar, but my previous sergeant was the sergeant of the crime scene unit and invited me along on a couple calls. And it turned out that, you know, that work I really loved. So I was in major crime for 9 years, crime scene detective for 2, went over to become a sergeant of the criminal investigative unit at the troop I was at for 2 years, and then back to the crime scene unit as a sergeant, where I stayed for until I got promoted to lieutenant, and then kind of upwards from there.
Okay. And then when did you first start doing some of your training, like, for example, in bloodstain pattern analysis and the shooting reconstruction stuff?
Yeah, I mean, really our crime scene unit, and I guess for the audience too. So the state of Connecticut, we kind of divide in thirds for the state police vertically. And there's 3 districts here, West Central and East. Each of those districts, there's 11 troops, give or take. They have 4, 3, and 4 as we kind of move west to east across the state. And each of those districts has a crime scene unit. So, you know, as a result of that work, we're strictly processing crime scenes. Some for the state police and some for local PDs that may have a detective bureau and not a crime scene unit, or may not have any detectives at all. And you know, we support them by processing their scenes. So, you know, the exposure to bloodstain scenes started there and really kind of elevated when I went to graduate school at the University of New Haven and started doing research there relative to BPA. And then, you know, pretty much 2014 on, I've been kind of focused on that and the shooting reconstruction aspects of investigation and forensic science.
Okay, so hold on. So 2014, so around the time when I first met you, was that when you were starting at New Haven?
I just had finished there.
Oh, just finished.
So,
okay.
Yeah, 2012 I started. 2011, end of 2011, I started at New Haven.
Okay,
so
okay.
Kind of wrapping up there.
And so the teaching that you're in your bio, I was reading like some of the teaching that you're doing, that's like internal with your team, or do you do it for other agencies as well as the university?
Yeah, the university is university work. And then internal training here with the state police, it's for the state police or other local PDs. So we kind of bring in a mix of detectives to some of these different trainings that we're able to hold here. So,
okay. Yeah. All right. Well, let's move on to the subject at hand here, the whole Sandy Hook thing. That was obviously something that made, I would say, world news. It was a big deal. It was very tragic and everything else. And, you know, I kind of just want to let you talk about, you know, kind of like you did in your presentation, which was just sort of how things began for you at the time. You know, what was your day like that day? And, you know, just the first bits of information, how they were coming through and how everything sort of fit together.
Yeah. Ultimately, with this topic, you know, a lot of the, I'd say core group here, but kind of the people that were intimately involved with the incident are, you know, I think a lot of times reticent to discuss it, right? And we've, you know, this is probably the third time, you know, that I've talked semi-publicly or publicly in this case. And a lot of our discussion internally and to other audiences is really focused on learning lessons from it. You know, one, because that information is vital to help save lives for police officers that are responding, or, you know, and then further, just relative to lessons learned, you know, in some aspects about the investigation, the investigative piece, and then really also too, and maybe to some degree, more importantly, the mental health aspect to it, or the aftermath of the incident from the law enforcement side. So, you know, that said, and you know, in this forum, details likely I'm going to keep to a minimum, but yeah. So, I mean, I worked in Litchfield at the time, or on that day, so we're talking about the western third of the state here, Newtown or Sandy Hook. You know, that's a subsidiary of Newtown. That's the town where it occurred. Is kind of the southwestern part of the state. Litchfield's maybe 35 minutes or so north of that. So it was early morning. 9 o'clock was essentially the when 911 calls started going out to the PD. Some of those calls rolled over to the state police. So around that time period, you know, we were kind of alerted, particularly the troop in Southbury, Troop A, which that's their area, you know, and people began responding from there. So my lieutenant ultimately called me on the phone. I was, you know, in my office. I was a sergeant at the time, and I supervised the criminal investigative unit up at Troop L. So a group of street detectives essentially there. So at any rate, that was the call. It was shocking, really, to hear. It took a little bit of time to like kind of process that. And I don't mean minutes, but you know, it was there was some processing that needed to happen there. And then, you know, we were lights and siren down to Newtown from there. You know, it was really, really down there it was an overwhelming response of law enforcement. I think you kind of don't realize, or I didn't really maybe until that time, how many law enforcement people from all different agencies, local, state, federal, any number of federal agencies are up and about and around. You know, there was hundreds of law enforcement response there. So, you know, ultimately by the time we got down there, the incident was over, and, you know, our ESU or our SWAT team was in the process of clearing the school and going through those motions. And, you know, us from Major Crime ultimately began to make a plan in order to, you know, execute our portion of the investigation. So that's kind of the ideology of how I ended up down there.
Okay. And so let me ask you, Mark. So when the call first came in from the school, like, were there multiple callers from the school calling all at the same time, like the teachers, the principal, like whoever calling in, and like, is there just like a flood of information coming in all of a sudden, or was it fairly broken apart to start with, and then maybe more coming in later? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, there were several calls from the school, not an overwhelming amount from what I recall from the investigative part. And so, you know, it was that information that was coming in, but you know, and this is an important part too for, you know, for the dispatch side of it, because they're the focal point right now of any incident that's coming in. So, you know, how they take in information, what questions are asked, and all that information, which they're all very good at doing, but you know, all that's important relative to expedition of response, where people are going to tactically deploy. And so, you know, Newtown PD was receiving those calls. A lot of times cell phone calls will roll over to the state police PSAP. So Troop A and Troop L started getting some calls too relative to that. So,
okay. So when you arrived, I mean, there's gotta be, you know, paramedics, there may be fire, there may be SWAT teams, there may be like all, you know, different troops, different things going on. So is it a little bit of confusion, or is it a little bit of, you know, communication and everything else, you know, trying to keep everything straight at that point? Like what's the communication like at that point?
Yeah. I mean, ultimately, yeah, and this is one of these where, you know, we say, you know, this is part of our lessons learned part, like, are you prepared to respond to this? Right. And the answer is probably for every agency, you're not, right? In some sense you are, you know, training is adapted and evolved, but you know, all of these are, they're the same, but they're very vastly different. So at any rate, you know, here, yeah, I mean, it's a chaotic type of response, but you know, the initial responding officers, and you know, we've been trained in active shooter investigations, but really in response. So that, you know, the initial responding Newtown police officers and state police from Troop A are going through the process of entering the school and clearing it. By the time we got there, and this is a, you know, like a tactical lesson, but so we don't have a map up here, but the school is, well, just say it's like down the end of a cul-de-sac. So there's a long driveway. There's the fire department when you pull in on the left-hand side, and there's a quarter mile road that goes down to the school. So with the flood of responding vehicles, that roadway was clogged. So if people are getting in, you know, stopping their car, getting out of their car, running down the road, if they're a SWAT person or somebody else that's responding, you know, the roadway was clogged. So, you know, ultimately one of the takeaways just from that aspect of it was, and you know, this is easier said than done, right? Now, but you know, keep a clear roadway. So, you know, if we can have ambulances ingress and egress, which ultimately they were able to do, you know, the unfortunate part of that was there was not really much egress from there. So,
mm-hmm.
But yeah, a lot of, you know, the initial, you know, the initial part there, and ultimately like law enforcement response here, you have Newtown, you have state police, we're on different radios, but the people that are there are communicating, you know, and then back up. So there's always going to be some friction. It's the fog of war, essentially, right? Relative to that. And you just have to adapt to that and overcome. But ultimately communications, you know, on how people are clearing the building, and to upper command relative to what they see or what is going on inside is important, because those, again, tactical decisions are going to need to be made at an elevated level sometimes. So if they don't have the right information, you know, it's hard to execute some of those decisions.
Okay. So after some time, like while you were there, whatever, maybe you can just clarify this for me, but what were your responsibilities during that time? And were there any other responsibilities laid upon you while you were there? Like you were assigned to do other things maybe that you didn't expect?
So ultimately there, since I was the sergeant, a criminal investigative sergeant, my counterpart who was I was at L, he was at A in Southbury. So like ultimately it was their case to handle. I worked with him for a long time. We worked together down at Troop G. We're very familiar with each other. We worked on a number of different cases. So, you know, our piece to that was the investigative side. You know, in first here, there's a lot of confusing information coming out because, you know, ultimately, you know, the shooter is a person. Shooter is confirmed deceased inside the school. We don't know if there was other people there, accomplices or you know, other portions of this to track down. So there was some, there's always going to be in these information that comes up that, you know, somebody needs to track down. So the initial like coordination of that information and who's going to do what takes a little bit of time to get established. But ultimately, you know, for us, we're executing our methodology relative to investigation. So if we have to track down, you know, we needed to know essentially like who else was in the school or who was in the school, because this aspect of it, you know, and like in the case of Maine, you have an unknown shooter. Like that's kind of the worst case scenario. And that's happened in San Bernardino and other places too. You know, in this case, we have a suspect deceased, but we don't know what else was going on there. So, you know, we don't want to jump to conclusions that this is the only person involved, because we have there's a forensic aspect to this too, right? So getting some of that settled was, you know, the kind of some initial friction there. But then we really went into our methodology, which, you know, we set up an investigative CP that was handled by the other sergeant, which was essentially offsite. And ultimately for my portion of that, everybody kind of collected at the firehouse at the end of the road, which was, there was a lot of chaos in there. You know, that's something that, you know, probably in hindsight, because you have parents there trying to reunite with their children. You have parents there that are unable to do that. And everybody else from law enforcement command, other commands, people that want to help, local politicians are all converging in essentially one spot. So that became quite chaotic there. But ultimately, you know, it boils down to the task for my group was to interview everybody that we possibly could relative to what they saw, what was going on inside the school, who was there, who wasn't there. And so that was kind of our initial, you know, our initial task there. So kind of makeshift investigative CP in the firehouse. And there's a couple lessons like relative to that. You know, one is that, you know, so typically our typical protocol is two detectives interview a subject. Like we don't have people to do that. We had not like 90 people to interview that were there. So you have to adapt to these things. So we grabbed any other detectives that were there, other people, tasked them with an interview. It's all documented. They can get initial information. They know what's relevant to at least that point in time, you know, initial actions or sights or sounds or whatever else they saw inside the school. And then we can ferret that information out later. So there's you have to adapt your process here to kind of some of the surrounding circumstances.
Yeah.
So that was one big lesson there.
You mentioned the families, and I remember you talking about that too. And obviously, you know, there's people who are tragically affected by this whole thing, and especially initially rushing to the school as soon as they hear the news and everything else. So how do you typically manage the families, these people that are, you know, just waiting to hear news and things like that? Do you assign people just to manage the families?
Yeah, ultimately, and that was, you know, probably in things that just for pre-planning. And, you know, I know in Connecticut, and I think across the nation, it's fairly uniform, kind of like a model response. But, you know, a family liaison area that's separate from the chaos, if it can be established, right, is kind of a better way to go here, which we didn't have that initially. It kind of evolved after a little bit of time into that. You know, and the reuniting aspect, like the more planning you can do and organized you can get that, the better off you are, because it's traumatic for, you know, one of our troopers was a parent. His son was, you know, a first grader in that school, different classroom. But, you know, so there's it's traumatic. And, you know, ultimately, you know, how it went down there was not the best because there was a lot of confusion. So, you know, later on for us, and this I think was one of the better aspects to it, was we had a trooper assigned to each family that was, you know, directly affected, you know. So, and whether that trooper was with them, whether they wanted to utilize the trooper or not utilize them, some did, some didn't, right? It varies on how they want to or feel, but at least that liaison was there to deflect media or get something for them or coordinate or do any of that. And I think that was fairly well received for the most part, an important aspect, because ultimately too here, and I happen to be the fortunate that my lieutenant and another major crime lieutenant are very victim centric and people centric leaders. So, you know, one of the bigger lessons overarching that I took from my lieutenant was that kind of victim centric focus, which I tried to carry forward here. So
can you give me a sense of the time that, for example, the people that were doing like the evidence recovery and stuff like that were inside the school? Like, was this, I mean, because of the number of victims in this case, I mean, was this like a 2 day, 3 day, like how much time are we talking about spending there collecting evidence?
Yeah, our crime scene unit they were there for 8 days. And our investigative portion of that was essentially also 8 days. So, you know, they, you know, ultimately here, we kind of had four scenes, right? We had the school, we had external to the school, because there was some ballistic evidence external to the school. We had the house where the shooter's mother was killed, and then ancillary at the hospital, right? So, but they spent eight days there. We had our investigative CP stood up for 8 days. And this is another, you know, probably lesson learned more for the investigative side. But the fact is that while we were engaged. And we ran, the crime scene unit didn't run ultimately 24 hours, right? They can't do that, but we can run detectives 24 hours. So we had 24 hour coverage on our CP there. But ultimately, from the investigative side, while you have those resources there, you need to get done what you can get done. And if you need to extend it, then extend it. Because once we break down the CP, all the support kind of goes away. So, you know, my counterpart, you know, my team of detectives were assisting them. But ultimately, the remainder of the case after that 8 days, which took them over a year to kind of pick through everything, was relegated to that office. So, you know, that was a decision that we made collaboratively. Like, are we ready to break this down? Do we have done what we need done here? And we can kind of dissipate some of our support. And the crime scene unit there was, you know, they were embedded for that period of time. And I think if you can imagine here, this is, you know, ultimately once we determined, which was essentially the first day into the night, that there was most likely just one person involved, you know, so it's not only processing the scene, but, you know, the reconstruction aspect of them took them, you know, a long time to go through, because we're talking about, you know, when we talk about, like, in reconstruction, all the functional and relational detail of a scene or an environment. So they had, you know, that all that needs to be documented, you know, how the door is locked, where they lock from, does the intercom work, all these type of things. And communication between the investigators and the crime scene unit is key to success here for capturing all that data that's there. Because outside of the evidence-based aspect of it, when some of those questions come up from the outside, the crime scene team needs to know, you know, this question's being asked. Does this work? You know, which way does this face? Do these doors open both ways or one way? How do they open? All that type of detail. So that documentation was pretty painstaking for them, but that they were a solid veteran team and, you know, got it all accomplished. Because we need to know, you know, in this case, it's not who, but from the investigative side, it's why, which wasn't plainly evident, you know, for the victims and their families. You know, and then the how part is the crime scene unit's charge.
Okay. In terms of technology, like, did you guys have things? I'm just curious, like things like drones, laser scanners, stuff like that. Were there agencies coming, say, hey, we want to help. We want to. I imagine because of the scale of this thing, you must have had people knocking at your door, just saying, hey, like, we want to help or whatever you need, kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah, there was certainly a lot of support there. This like predated our Leica scanner days. In fact, it was really the catalyst for our procurement for the crime scene unit. But ultimately, our crash reconstruction team was able to document and create kind of a 3D version of events from their mapping, which is what we used. But there was certainly no shortage of offers from any avenue.
How important is video in the investigation? Like security camera video and stuff like that?
Yeah, you know, I think it's data that's available, right? If it's there, which provides, you know, I think a fair representation maybe of what happened. You know, my opinion on video to some degree, particularly if we're talking about like finite actions, is I think people are over reliant on it to you know, maybe not a large degree, but you know, we just tend to see what we think we see on video and take it for fact without, you know, you need to consider alternate circumstances to some of these things. I just think it's very easy to slip into some version of a confirmation bias. It depends on when you watch the video. Obviously, when you watch it is, I think, equally as important as what's there, you know, because ultimately, if I watch it first and then I have an opinion, I may only collect evidence that's relative to that opinion, right? Just the same as we go through any type of cognitive process with reconstruction. So certainly important, maybe for leads, maybe for the reconstruction aspect. But, you know, it's another piece of data that's to be used and then, you know, weighed relative to its probative value and its reliability.
Okay. Hey, Mark, did you ever, like, while you were on scene or after, you know, thinking back on like what had happened, was there anything that you maybe thought of and said, you know what, it would have been nice to have had something? And, you know, in my mind, like what I'm thinking about is like some kind of really quick and easy case management system or something like this. Do you know what I mean? Like where you can bring all the evidence very quickly together because you're dealing with so many people.
Yeah. So that's a good, actually a great question. And one of the takeaways we had from there. So because ultimately from the investigative standpoint, and this is one of these things where we had, you know, we had a team of primary investigators, you know, whose task specific focus was this incident and this incident only. You know, ultimately we had an intelligence detective there who was keeping a log essentially of activities that came in, you know, really kind of rudimentary. So yeah, that case management system that, you know, we've seen at some conferences that we've been to relative to that, you know, the FBI has one, the Leo, you know, relative to keeping track of some of those. So we were, you know, we were executing that as we went along. You know, a more automated process probably would have saved time and been a little bit more efficient. But, you know, that was a key aspect to look to at least leaving a trail of where we were going and what we were doing investigatively. Because for a lot of times, like we have lead sheets, they're carbon copy. Like I still like those because they're here, they're tangible. I write down a lead. I rip off the top copy. I give it to a detective. I put it in the pending box, right? When he comes back or she comes back with it, I look at what the information says. Do we develop any other leads? Yeah, we go from there and that one's closed. But it's all paper, right? So automation is good, which we eventually got those automated. I still do carry a stack of paper ones in my trunk just in case. So, you know, that was an important aspect there. The other part too, I'll just say about the investigation piece, which was really critical, I think, and one of the better things that we had there was, you know, so one, it was established that the state police were the primary investigators on the case, right? And so there wasn't anything to deconflict there. So that was established right away. But we had in our command post, we had FBI agents, we had US Marshals, we had ATF agents, we had state's attorneys, we had federal prosecutors, and then we had another team of investigators that were there to handle, unfortunately, all the other ancillary threats and other things that come in on the heels of some of these things, right? So we have threats on other schools. We had bomb threats. We had all sorts of distracting, essentially, you know, not unimportant if they're real, but things that need to be investigated but are not task specific to our investigation. So that other team of investigators was there on standby. And when something came in, they went and investigated it. So that whole team that was assembled there and streamlined process so really enabled us to move forward quickly with the work that needed to be done relative to the investigative piece, and was a huge value add, because for any of these incidents, all these other things are gonna occur, and they're distracting, and somebody needs to be tasked to handle them. So, you know, that said too, we also had detectives whose sole job it was to screen some information that was coming in. And if it wasn't task specific, it got documented and went elsewhere, so we could focus on our work.
Right. Mark, I want to ask you about the, obviously there's going to be some emotional, some mental health things that we mentioned before. Going into this and knowing, you know, maybe when you got there, the scale of this, was there any consideration either like before, during, or after about who was going to get assigned to do what? And, you know, maybe, you know, some, like you said, you had a team member there that had, you know, a child at school, right? So I don't know, was it, you know, safe to put that person maybe doing one thing versus another? And, you know, what did you notice maybe with respect to, you know, just the emotions of people and the mental health of people along this investigation?
Yeah. Thanks for bringing that up. It's, yeah, I think, you know, ultimately here, and I can talk from, I guess, my personal experience and observations, but, you know, I think initially everybody is, you know, it's shocking, but people focus on the task at hand and get to work. Now we were there for eight days. So at some point, two or three days as we're moving through this, and this is a leadership type of issue essentially, or engagement, right? We talk to the detectives in sense of, and not just like, hey, how's it, you're all right. But meaningfully asking, right? I mean, the lieutenant that was responsible for myself and the other sergeant and the team pulled everyone aside, sat us down, looked at us in the eyes, made sure we were like engaging, and asked us how we were doing, right? And this is, and similarly to the detectives. And if somebody needed a break or couldn't work that day, then they took a break and took the afternoon or whatever their shift was. And there's no, there's no stigma attached to that. Coming from my days in the Marine Corps, which was, I guess, a longer time ago now than maybe I want to admit, but, that whole like tough guy type of thing has really, really eroded and should have, right? Because it's not healthy. So during that process, we did that. People needed a break, they got a break, and there's no issues with it, right? We had chaplains there, we had EAP there, support services, if available, if somebody needed to engage. So that was, that was a big part of it. But ultimately here, why you're engaged and working, you're focused on the task. I can tell you that, I had, my son was 4 years old at the time. When I went home that first night, I couldn't look at him because I would have broke down. So, in order to like remain focused, just came home, went to bed, went back to work. And ultimately that when we broke down the CP after the eighth day, I'm a big Dunkin' Donuts person. So I stopped at Dunkin' Donuts, which, what do you have up in, what's in Canada?
Tim Hortons.
Yeah. We don't have those here. I stopped in Dunkin' and I didn't really need to go there, but I was like hesitant to go home, I guess. Right. I called one of my friends, and we had a chat, just because we're going from such an intensely focused environment to now having to deal with or process a lot of different things. So, that was my initial, I guess, experience with, hey, like something, there's things going on here, right, that need to be processed. So, the agency was very supportive with it. But ultimately, as with a lot of these traumatic events, and whether it's from a singular event or accumulated from, law enforcement over time, they manifest at different times. So, a week after you're done and recovered and like you've rested up and back to work does not necessarily mean you're okay, right? So these things manifest at different times, and there's a lot of different triggers that occur depending on what you experience and then what you experience further on. So watching out for your people or your peers is important post event too. And like you say, I know I brought this up at the IABPA conference that, a couple of years, maybe removed, 2 years removed, we had an ATV accident. A 10-year-old was killed on an ATV. So the troop asked for detectives to come out and help them with that scene. I assigned a detective that was, with our investigation, without really thinking, like, because he had, one, he had children, two, he had experienced that Sandy Hook event. And it didn't dawn on me until later the next day that, hey, maybe I should have checked with him and said, are you okay going out to, yet another child death? Because, these things pile on. So, and if the answer was, I'd rather not do that, sergeant, then that's fine. We'll get somebody else to do it. But I didn't think of that till after. So I did ask him after and apologize, really, that, hey, I should have checked with you. Didn't occur to me. And so those type of like post-incident assignments are you know, from a leadership perspective, something to be taken into account with the with your personnel, and then, you know, further, you have to watch out for each other. So that's all that's very important. And these things still, you know, they still crop up every now and again, right? Unexpectedly too. You don't, it's kind of sometimes strange, right?
Yeah. No, I was going to ask you too, like, you know, how do you take care of yourself after, how do you take care of your peers? Like, you know, and you mentioned, like, obviously having a good network of friends and community and stuff like that. And, you know, you're wrestling, and I know you work out and you run and you do, and you're pretty dedicated with that too. So obviously, you know, getting stress out is very helpful mentally as well. Like having that physical, you know, outlet helps you mentally as well. But you know, I don't know, you know, what works for you?
Yeah, I think definitely having an outlet is important, a healthy one, right? And when I was at the training academy, you know, I said, told these recruit classes, and this really comes from this experience, is like, look, it's a stressful environment there. You have to carve out time for yourself. And whatever form that takes, if it's being alone for a half an hour in the morning, then that's fine. If it's being with your family or your friends, you know, whatever it is, you need to carve out time for yourself to do this, right? So, yeah, I mean, I have a lot of outlets. You know, physical exercise is certainly one of them. Teaching is another. You know, I mean, the forensic aspect to some of the casework that we do, although it's, you know, still related to death, is helpful for me. You know, I do some writing, and
you coach too.
I coach wrestling. I volunteer at a therapeutic horse farm, which has been great. You know, one, helping out the kids that go there, you know, but you know, for me, I started there in the veterans program, you know, so that association with horses has been, you know, unexpected, but really, you know, really a good outlet. They're there for you.
Right. Yeah.
So a lot of that, all those things are important, you know, and then you need a good support network, but you know, awareness of that too is also critical. And at the 2014 conference, if you remember, Joe Slemko from Edmonton did a presentation on essentially PTSD, right? And they have a great program for their members, and it may be all across Canada. I don't know, but I know he's in Edmonton. You know, where they're really embedded in education relative to that, and the continuum that you kind of flow back and forth on between green and, you know, hopefully not red, where you're actually injured. But that education and that awareness is important for people to realize, you know, what my behaviors are, where I may be on this continuum. Do I need to get help or talk to somebody? And, you know, and again, it doesn't have to be a focal point traumatic event. You know, I mean, I think from having to answer my phone continuously at all times, I don't like my phone ringing anymore, you know, so that's another accumulated stress or anxiety, but you know, with these outlets are helpful to keep you centered, along with whatever other support network you need, and really looking out for your peers too.
Yeah. I imagine that, you know, once things had settled a little bit after all the investigation and everything else, that there was probably like a few, I imagine more than one big, you know, debrief, you know, different aspects of just the whole event, and, you know, maybe some changes or some suggested changes in protocols or like things like that. Is there anything that you know that maybe with respect to the schools, for example, because I mean, they had the door locked and things like that, but are there any things that came out of the investigation, either for, you know, prevention, for, you know, during an incident like that or post incident?
Yeah, I think, you know, in our, and some of the things we discussed that, you know, internally, the crime scene unit debriefed, the investigative unit debriefed, you know, overall the state police's handling was another aspect, but, you know, certainly hardening of schools really resulted in large part from that, you know, and in this case, the doors were locked, you know, they were locked down, they went into their protocol. But there's, you know, in any examination of a scene relative to an event, there's always room for improvement. So, you know, the hardening of schools really developed, I think, from that. And not only that, but then also tactics, because if you harden your school, I need to be able to get into it if I need to as a first responder, right? So so there's some education and planning that has to go into that piece of it too. You know, and I think, you know, larger takeaways from this for us logistically, it was a massive undertaking for the agency, you know, with the assistance of a lot of other places, you know, where we were able to support the families, either with the liaisons, you know, and then from the investigative side with some debriefs to them specifically and focused on them before any other information came out. Cause that was, you know, it's always try not to re-traumatize and, you know, we need to establish trust, you know, that, and that was my lieutenant and my counterpart, the sergeant, really driving that process to make sure that they were able to be as supportive as we could as they went through this. So yeah, a lot, you know, some tactical lessons, strategic planning lessons. And then, you know, from the external part, you know, really the schools were tightening up kind of how they secured themselves.
Yeah. I think in light of like all the other shootings that have been going on in other places, so, and not all of them at schools, but like there was a long time ago, I'm trying to remember it was the Parkland School in Florida. I remember that was a big one too. Obviously the main one that we talked about, and more recently, I think in Texas is Uvalde, there was a shooting there. Yeah. So it seems to be reoccurring. And so have you thought about I don't know if there's a way to share a lot of your learning experiences, obviously going to conferences and things like that, but you know, this is going to keep happening. I hate to say, but you know, at least if this information is shared amongst, especially the people who have already had a situation like this, and maybe they can learn from each other, it might be interesting to somehow form a little program or something where people who, I mean, I'm assuming that, you know, in Connecticut and you know, in Newtown, you know, they weren't expecting probably something like this to happen. I mean, I looked at, you know, looking at it, it looks like a decent neighborhood and everything else. So,
yeah.
I, you know, just when you said, you know, are you prepared? You know, probably people don't think that this is going to happen to them, but, you know, it did for you guys, right? So,
sure.
Yeah.
Definitely the lessons learned here. And I know, you know, my previous lieutenant, you know, we did a presentation actually in Maine to their major crime people a few years back, and he'd been traveling different places as requested. You know, can we get a talk on this relative to the lessons that were learned? You know, some more specifics there, but either way, and that's kind of the whole point of like when he discusses it or if I do, you know, or from the investigative side is really to help other agencies with that. Not only investigative, but the aftermath part, you know, and also for a tactical response because time here saves lives. Like, you know, the public has an expectation of law enforcement for these incidents, which is get in there and stop the threat. And, you know, that is really our mandate. So, and the faster that people can do that, you know, the less traumatic, hopefully these events will be. But yeah, certainly sharing those. And the other thing, you know, my lieutenant also had been to talk to victims from different, I don't know if it was a forum, different shootings, right? To get their perspective, like what could law enforcement do to help them better? And the salient one for me from one aspect was, look, we're in there. Our job is to clear the threat, go to the threat, find the threat. So if people are injured, they're ultimately getting bypassed until we can stop the shooting. So somebody said, if somebody like said to me, you know, we're here to help you, somebody will be here, or, you know, some comment like that, if it's, you know, even if anybody can remember it or it's possible that they, you know, the articulation was, and this is coming secondhand, that would have helped them. So, you know, the victim aspect too, I think, you know, we pulled away a lot of, you know, lessons on how to, you know, not re-traumatize, or how to be as empathetic and transparent as we could with the victims, because, you know, we're there to really support them too. So that was, you know, another kind of takeaway relative to that aspect of lessons learned too.
Yeah. Hey, Mark, in terms of pre-planning, there's an interesting, I'll take a question here from somebody in the audience. This is Jerry Myers. Did you have access to the school floor plan right away? The community there, was it fairly well known to the police there? Are they familiar with all the schools and stuff like that already? So it wasn't really that important? Or were there people going into this thing, you know, blind?
Yeah, I mean, the PD may have, they may, the police department, I'm sure, had access to it. You know, but with a lot of these, you know, active shooter is active shooter. So, you know, you don't have time to study a map. You know, it's essentially go in and move to the sound of the guns. You know, then, but follow on relative to that, you know, it becomes important for the people that are like one step removed from there. Particularly now, if I'm articulating, I'm in this hallway. I went in the front door. I just took a left, and I'm going down this long hallway, and I see room 28. Now the map becomes important because then I can be directed, or at least orient somebody on the outside to information to where I am. So, you know, I know currently all our schools in Connecticut are required to submit plans and emergency action plans. So, you know, they're all available. And we have cameras up. We have access to a lot of cameras in the schools as well. So, you know, we could switch over and dispatch and look at the cameras from what the school sees. So, you know, and that's advanced, you know, beyond the 2014. But yeah, so it's important. It depends on, I guess, where you are in the process.
Okay, that's interesting. I didn't know that you'd had access to school. Like, so are there a number of schools that you have access to that in case something happens, you can just look in?
Yeah. And up in Litchfield, you know, it's kind of like it's a website. So we're on there, you know, we have access to it so we can look at their cameras, you know, and we do drills. We've done drills with them relative to being able to get into the school when they're locked down and proceed to a certain location. Right. So, you know, some of these things, and of course, whatever you practice won't be what happens, but you know, you'll have some semblance of the moving parts to how to execute once your boots hit the ground.
Yeah, right. Yeah, so Mark, so what's next for you? I mean, there's all these lessons learned. You went out, you presented this at ACER last year. And are you looking to do any more in this particular area, or like looking to share this with other people? You know, I don't know. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the ACER presentation was, you know, and that really came out of a mental health discussion at our previous BPA conference. And, you know, a lot of my former lieutenant has talked to a lot of different PDs that are requested, you know, some of those I go with him on, because it's good to kind of team up for some of these things, you know, in order to go through that. But I think any information that law enforcement, you know, wants or needs, you know, particularly if you've experienced it, is important for them to be able to kind of derive or fortify their plans relative to some of these type of nuances that come up that you wouldn't normally know, right?
Yeah, for sure.
We can learn from, you know, unfortunately, all the incidents since, you know, as well, so.
Yeah, well, I thought it was interesting, like I said, when I was speaking to the officers from Maine and, you know, sitting around the table and just, you know, they're coming up with all these different themes, and I'm just thinking, Mark said that, you know, all the same thing over and over. And if that's the case at any of these things, then, you know, maybe there's some things that could really help in the future with a lot of these incidents. So yeah, I think it's great. And I hope you do get out a bit more and share more of this, more of the lessons learned. I think it was a very good presentation. And obviously, you know, this is just a discussion here, but I think, you know, when you presented it, it went over really, really well. So yeah, thank you for that.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate it.
Do you mind if, in case anyone is interested in reaching out, do you mind if I put up your LinkedIn contact information here?
Yeah, sure. No problem.
Yeah, let me put this up here, folks. So yeah, so Mark is there. It's just Mark Davison and on LinkedIn. And in case you're interested or you have any questions, or maybe you're at an agency where, you know, you just want to be prepared for potentially something happening in the future, or you know, training advice or materials, Mark is open to helping you out there a little bit, so which would be great. So, all right, Mark, awesome. Well, look, I'm not sure where you're going to be next, or if we're going to bump into each other at another conference. I'm not sure what you have in your schedule. Well, maybe are you going to go to IABPA next, maybe?
Yeah, for sure there. So I'll be there if you're there.
Yeah, I'll plan to be there. I've sort of have a streak going, so I don't want to break my streak now.
Yeah, so. I'm with you on that. Yeah, for sure.
Right.
Yeah. On. Well, next week I'll miss last week of wrestling. So.
Yeah, you got a commitment there.
Coaching good. Duties. So.
Right on. Well, look, thank you so much. Do me a favor, hang back a bit, and then I'll come back in a second.
Sounds good. Thanks, Eugene. Right.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks for everyone who's chimed in the comments, and I hope to see you soon. Have a good Thursday, everyone. Bye-bye.